So, Rebecca Sode, let's read some emails and comments. What do you say?
I'm here for it.
So, this first comment is from someone responding to the episode where you talked about the Israel-Hamas war. And this person, anonymous patron, says, I just listened to your episode on Israel. I really appreciated hearing Rebecca's take on this issue. I appreciate you putting yourself out there to say this. End of email. And a lot of people commented and emailed. When you talked about it, you were worried that everyone, or a good portion, a worrisome portion of people would not only just disapprove, but would cancel you or hate you or turn on you or attack you or dox you or come get you. What happened?
It's been overwhelmingly positive. Like I cried about it with my therapist yesterday. Not at all what I had expected. And such, we got such interesting comments back. A lot of people wrote me individually. One, I heard a lot of thank yous for us having a nuanced conversation on this issue. And one of my dear, dear friends, who's Italian-American, was talking about how even she grew up in the most argumentative culture she knows. And even she is tired of arguing these days. And to just hear two people talk was like almost relaxing to her. So, yeah, I mean, we did something good there, Kirk.
Was it therapeutic because of your history with these kinds of conflicts with people in your life?
So it was great with you to have a really thoughtful conversation. So the act of this conversation in itself was really amazing. And then just to hear from so many of my friends who were like, wow, thank you. I had the same opinion. I never brought this issue up with you because I was afraid that your opinion would be different than mine. Or I'm really ready to talk and listen to people. I'm tired of arguing with people. So there was the internal circle part that was really nice. And then kind of the outer circle, the kind of World Wide Web circle, it was just great to see how many people told their stories themselves of how they got to their opinion. That was really what stuck with me was, yeah, we've all gotten to these opinions, but why? And if we can listen to each other at all, can things get better? And things have gotten so much worse since we recorded that episode in terms of the death toll for people in Palestine. Today is the November 8th.
Seven.
As of yesterday, 10,000 Palestinians had died in this conflict. Like, this is truly horrible. And I actually read in the New York Times today, there was actually a quote, or the article was, Democrats, American Democrats under pressure to call for ceasefire from their constituents. I was like, oh, wow. You know, there is a conversation happening. And so I'm glad our listeners are having that conversation and want to hear that conversation.
When things like this happen, there is a tendency for the anti-Semitism to emerge.
Yeah.
They're just looking for an excuse to hate. So have you seen anything like that?
Yeah. So just today in the Seattle Times, there was an article about a temple that is in close proximity to my house had a letter delivered to it, and the person opened the letter and white crystals fell out, and they called 911 right away. It wasn't
anthrax. Yeah,
it wasn't anthrax, but the threat was there. It could have, you know, the threat was to say, we want to exterminate you.
Yeah, I mean, there are shootings, there are bombs, there are crimes of violence and vandalism that happen regularly. So
yeah, they vandalized Katz's Deli in L.A. I mean, this is right. I mean, there is the other side of this. I want to speak out about violence against the Palestinian people. And the flip side that I hadn't really thought about until we recorded was I was reminded that Jews are like 0.2% of the world's population. And most of your listeners may have never met a Jew or had a conversation with a Jew or know that Jews had a variety of opinions or how Jews were brought up. I was really struck by how many people said, boy, I had no idea what a Jewish childhood, Jewish education, and, you know, that was a long time ago, that story I was telling, but, you know, what it looked like. And so if we can have any dialogue at all about what it's really like for just one Jewish person, go out and find another Jewish person and talk to them. But yeah, I might be the only Jewish voice that some of our listeners ever hear besides a famous person. Mm-hmm. And that's really important because that's what stops anti-Semitism. So I, on the flip side, I went to my office and I put a mezuzah, which is a traditional prayer, in a box, a tiny plastic rectangular box. It's not plastic. Mine is plastic. Usually they're metal or wood. They're made out of all kinds of things, and it goes on your doorpost and it identifies your home as a Jewish home. And I put one up at my business after we recorded. Because the flip side of this is I only want to be more out as a Jew. I only feel like it's more important that people see that there's lots of ways to be Jewish. There's Jews holding all kinds of opinions. And that the tenets of actual Judaism, not what the Israeli government is doing, but the tenets of my faith are something that I love. And my family history and the ways that my family acts as a Jewish family. And, you know, I told that story about getting my DNA tested and knowing how much of me holds this story. And then I'm probably the first person in my lineage in thousands of years to live outside of a Jewish enclave. My mom's generation being the last. And my aunt and I were talking about this. She said that she didn't meet a non-Jewish person until high school. So I'm also I'm a Jewish person stepping out into the general world. And like, I don't know how to do that either. You know, like my family can't give me any advice on that.
So was talking about this in that episode recently along those lines, stepping outside of the community.
Oh, yeah. Saying anything against Israel in a public stance, that would have. Because like a lot of minority groups, I mean, I don't know if you were trained about this, about your Japanese heritage, that you don't say anything bad about your family or your heritage ever to non-people of that heritage.
Mm. Yeah. It's just kind of weird to me to think that there would be some sort of hard line around these sorts of things, because for me as an American, I have regularly disowned the government and its actions, past, present, and future.
Right.
My government locked up my people in World War II, literally imprisoned relatives of mine who were innocent citizens.
Sorry, I'm interrupting because I'm...
No, go ahead.
If there was no Japanese homeland to return to... If you're this is so complicated.
No, I'm just saying that.
I know what you're saying.
We reject the government regularly. You know, when they invaded Iraq without any firm plan and without any firm evidence of weapons of mass destruction, I was marching and was appalled. And when I would travel abroad, which didn't happen much, I think I was in Canada. And somehow it came out that I was American and people started attacking me. And I was just like, hey, I'm fighting the good fight. Mm-hmm. I'm doing what I can. And don't associate me with the actions of my government. My entire life has been in opposition to shit like that. And I take action and I vote and I march and I do all that. And I speak out. So don't blame me. If anything, I'm more upset than you are because I'm associated with this shit. So the notion that you could have a government that is representing a certain portion of the voting public in Israel, but there's a lot of people in Israel, we know this, who are in adamant opposition to the mindset and the various actions of this government. So this notion of like, it's between Jewish people and Israel and everyone else, it's like, well, no. There's a large portion of people who live in Israel and are suffering from the fear of the attacks that happen occasionally, and yet are saying, no, we can't treat these people this way, and we need to have a more humane approach here for the long term, right? I mean, am I wrong about that?
No, and I wonder how much this has to do with anti-Semitism. In the way that growing up, were you ever asked questions about what the Japanese government was doing?
No.
Okay.
Although I have been implicated as an imperialist in the same way that because of my Northwest European heritage, I've been blamed as an imperialist, which, you know, I accept that I come from that tradition. Because my people did live in occupied China and Korea, so relatives of mine.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the ways in which anti-Semitism works, is that all Jews must be the same and they must be hated. And so there's a way in which I get clumped in, and it doesn't, you know, nobody. So Bikur Holam Temple Synagogue is the temple in Seattle that got the anthrax, you know. Did the person who sent the anthrax, did they research them at all? Like, why is that temple being targeted for what is happening here? That is not a rational thought. You know, all that happens is you look around your neighborhood and think, the Jews, they're there.
Is your sense in the last couple of weeks that things are different now in terms of the discourse than they were 5-10 years ago?
Oh, yeah.
How so?
Well, I notice as an American Jew, I see an overwhelming presence. And I don't know if it's just my algorithm or what, but the amount of Jews that are protesting against this war publicly, really well organized. So there was the protest at the Capitol Rotunda that we talked about. There was one at Grand Central Station. There was one somewhere in Boston. There was one at the Statue of Liberty the other day. There will be one coming up to block a boat that's leaving out of Tacoma Harbor. I'm not quite sure what's happening with that one.
So before, you wouldn't have seen that?
I don't remember anything like this for previous wars.
So why is it changed?
I mean, is it the level of firepower that the Israeli government now has to use against the Palestinians? Is it the rate of the internet that all of these things now happen so fast and we know about them so fast?
Yeah, because the imagery is powerful.
Yeah, it is. And is so, here is my current thought on this. Growing up, it was always never again. The Holocaust can never happen again. And then there was this like extrapolation that because the Holocaust had happened and we lost 6 million Jews from Europe, we were then, the British government then gave us what was Palestine to become Israel. We kind of earned it so that we could have a safe homeland to repair from the Holocaust. And then the message I grew up with was, they hate us as Jews. Never again will the Holocaust, can the Holocaust happen. Having Israel means that the Holocaust can't happen again. And what I'm really seeing for American Jews is this concept that, like, Israel equals safety for us. Israel is our is where we will land as a people. I'm seeing that come into question. And you asked me last time, I'm not saying whether or not Israel can exist, but I am saying that there's an overwhelming people around me who are saying, this has become too violent. This has become too brutal. This doesn't stand with my Jewish values of what a, quote, homeland would be. I can't stand with the militaristic aspect of the Israeli government. You know, I heard something like 400,000 Israelis are being called up to service right now because almost everyone in the country has been trained for military service. So there is this huge mobilization, and so many people are saying, I don't want this.
What is it? So what's on the table?
I mean, I hear a two-state solution getting thrown around way more than I have before.
Rather than Israel and occupying Palestine.
Which is what Netanyahu says he's planning on doing next. It's horrific. Yeah. But, you know, we've way outdone eye for an eye here. Yeah.
Is that the main solution on the table, is two-state?
I think that's what I've always heard. I mean, I'm trying to keep up
live
to date.
Live and let live kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm trying to keep up to date as much as I can, but it's nearly impossible.
Because that would be pretty radical, right? Because there's so many Jewish settlements that are in what was traditionally Palestine, right?
Yeah. Well, and there's this whole other factor of how much Israel depends on Palestinian labor. You know, it's in the true apartheid state way, there's, you know, a call. I've seen calls for Americans to go to Israeli kibbutzes and help out on the farms there because the Palestinian labor can't get to the kibbutzes right now. So there is a way in which this whole system runs with Palestinians coming into Israel for low-wage jobs. And with this war happening, that can happen, and it's really impacting the Israeli agricultural economy, much like immigrant labor impacts our American economy when we shut down the borders.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, there is so much going on. And then, you know, a lot of people, you know, and there's so much history here. But I see more Jews than ever saying, just being horrified at the level of violence. I mean, one of the things that a lot of people are saying is, can you even call this a war? Because Palestinians have none of the resources that Israel has. So is this just an occupation of a militaristic government? Because there's no way that the Palestinians can fight back. And I've also heard a lot of talk about how much the American government is sending in arms. And, you know, as the American people, what can we do to really address that? And that's some of that is saying ceasefire, and some of that is saying send less, send nothing. They have plenty. They're doing just fine annihilating the people of northern Gaza.
Yeah. So how are you feeling today?
I cry about this issue. Cried about it in therapy yesterday. It is very intense. And one of the things we talked about was if my family has yet to report to me that they've listened to the podcast. So I'm kind of waiting for that.
Did you tell them?
I did not tell them. And I did not post on my social media the first.
How often did they listen?
They all listened to the My Mother Died episode.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know how they hear about it or how they access it. I'm not about to ask right now because I don't know if I could. That would be a really hard conversation. Yeah, my heart just aches.
Worry of
more deaths, and worry of, you know, can we keep in dialogue? Can the people close to me, can we keep in dialogue about this and not shut down? I'm going to see my dad in December, and we'll see then. And what role do I take in that conversation? Like, my dad is 83. Do I take on the role of the benevolent daughter and just listen? Do I get in an argument with my 83-year-old dad?
The way you talk about your dad, it sounds like he's open to talking.
Yeah, I just know. So I have heard this over and over again the last week or two since the episode was out. Like, so many people are saying to me, I just can't argue anymore with anybody. I'm so fatigued about arguing. And I realize I have that too. I don't want to argue with my dad. I would benevolently listen just to be in my dad's presence and be non-reactive because I'm just so tired of arguing with the people that I love.
I wonder if that's a sea change in our societal stress level.
Well, I was reading an article about how we've been arguing very hardcore with each other nonstop since 2015, since Donald Trump put his hat in the ring. And that the level of fatigue is, you know, 8 or 9 years of constant arguing. A lot of people are like, I can't do it anymore. I can't watch debates. I mean, it's really interesting how only five of the Republican candidates are showing up to the debate that's happening. Like, there's a traditional way in which our society has been about debate and discussion and arguing, and it does feel like there's this fatigue where people are like, I'm tired.
Right. All right, let's take a break. We get back.
Okay.
More emails. Okay, we're back from the break. So let's do an OPP, an old patron praise, for these people that became patrons all the way back in 2021.
That's a long time ago now.
And stayed patrons the whole time. These are all monthly deserving listeners. We have Joe from Carpentersville, Illinois. Kelly from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Lily from Chicago, Illinois. Carolina from Delta, British Columbia, Canada.
Hmm.
We have Athea from AE, oh, Dubai, from Dubai. Christina from Dublin, Ireland. Awesome Mersos from Illinois. You think that's their real name?
Yeah,
Awesome Mersos?
I think so.
Sally from...
Mr.
Ursos. It's Awesome Ursos. So, although it's hyphenated, so maybe it's their
maybe
last name.
Maybe that's their...
Yeah. Sally from Glen Rowan, Australia. Anne from Gusenberg, Deutschland, Germany. Amanda from Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Soraya from Houston, Texas. Jessica from Ithaca, New York. Ryan from Kent, Washington, where I was first living when I was born. And we have just the period, just, you know, a period, like a decimal point, from Kitchener, Ontario. We have Seth from Madison, Wisconsin. Jen from Mineral Bluff, Georgia. Alexa from Mount Vernon, Iowa. And Allison from Nanaimo, British Columbia.
Good Nanaimo
old,
bars.
Good old Nanaimo. What's that? Is that a...
Nanaimo bars? Yeah. You don't know what Nanaimo bars are?
No, what's that?
This is an emergency. This is a Canadian emergency. You don't know what I can't even say it.
Is that a place where you
Nanaimo
drink?
Bar.
Or
no,
what is it?
No. Nanaimo bar is a thing that you eat. It's like a... It's shaped like a brownie, but it's like cake on the bottom and then a layer of...
Is it named after
mushy,
the city
named
of
after
Nanaimo?
The town.
Oh, okay.
Layer of mushy goodness and then like a chocolate wafer on top or something. I'm getting it wrong. And the people of the Nanaimo will shame me for getting it wrong. Oh, yeah. But you gotta... Someone send Kirk... No, don't send Kirk some Nanaimo.
I'm not a huge sweets person.
Send us a Nanaimo bar recipe and I will make them and bring them to you.
Ooh. Oh. Okay. Yeah. Stacey will like that too. All right. Listener Leslie, she wrote in and said, can you talk about feminism? What do you... Well, just very briefly, Rebecca.
Oi.
They want you to talk about... Leslie is like, Rebecca's so topic request.
Feminism.
So Leslie asks, can you talk about feminism? Go.
So feminism is a concept that is in contrast to the patriarchy. In feminism, we say that women and men and all genders are equal to each other and deserve kind of equal standing. So, like, if you think of a feminist look at psychology in Seattle, it would say, wow, a male host has a female guest on. That's great. So my voice is being allowed to be equal to yours here in this setting. Feminism also looks at marginalized people and constructs of power throughout the world. So we look at the power differentials between children and parents. We look at the power differential between the enslaved and the oppressor. We look at history through a lens, not just through the take of white rich men, but through what did it look like for the lived experience of people who were in it. So things that have come out of feminism that you may not even realize if you're younger are things like Title IX, the fact that there's professional women's sports at all. The fact that...
Describe Title IX.
Title IX was a case that said that colleges should spend as much on women's sports as they do on men's sports. And if you look at how much specifically the average college spends on men's football, it is astronomical. Mm-hmm. And so Title IX asked for equality and that. So things like women would have to pay for their own uniforms, but men would not. You know, these are all things that got addressed in Title IX.
Was it just college sports? I thought it was employment in general, no?
I think Title IX started out as women's sports.
Huh. Okay.
There are other factors about women employment. So if we're going to look at women in the workforce in America, women still make, I think, 52 cents to every dollar that men make. And black women make even less. So the idea that I could do the same job but get paid less because of my gender, that is sexism, and that is something that feminists work hard to do. And then let's talk about feminism in therapy. The idea that it is because of feminist therapy that it is PTSD is A, discussed at all, and B, looked at something that people can survive and thrive after. If you have all at all been impacted by the fact that you can talk about childhood sexual abuse or abuse of any kind, you have the feminist movement to thank, because before the feminist movement of the 70s, that did not occur in our culture. What else can we thank feminism for? Current explosion.
Lots of things. Yeah, I mean,
expression of gender.
Yeah, expression of gender, sexuality.
The fact that women have orgasms.
Right. Medical care.
Right. The fact that we have access to safe abortions where we do.
Well, not only that, but just the general practice of not researching medications and treatments on women because women don't exist. And so there would be these medications. For example, Ambien was tested on men. And what the researchers would say is, well, we don't want to complicate the participant pool with people who might be pregnant because that could be a complication. But okay, just spend a little bit more time screening the participant pool and recognize that women aren't exactly the same as men anatomy-wise, and that they matter in the world. And you should at the very least be worried about lawsuits. And what happened was the dosage, women need only half as much Ambien as men do on average. And so you had, I don't know if you heard about like 10, 15 years ago, where all these women were driving in their cars on Ambien or roaming the neighborhood or eating a whole casserole in the middle of the night. And then they wake up and they look in their kitchen and it looks like someone broke into their house because they're basically sleepwalking or acting in a daze and not incorporating any kind of memories. And it was because there were so many women that were operating on twice the dose of Ambien, which is a sleep medication for those who don't know. And it was a huge problem. And that's just one tiny little example of all sorts of medical atrocities and unfairness that would happen indirectly and directly. So yeah, there's a lot of things that feminism has contributed to.
I thought of something else, which is that radio stations used to not play two female artists in a row. So I know no one listens.
By policy or something?
By policy, because of course someone would turn off the radio if they heard two women's songs back to back. But I think about this all the time when I'm listening to Sirius XM, which I love. But so they have several radio stations that are specific to an artist. Like they have Margaritaville, they have U2. They have not a single station for a female artist. So there's all these stations for men when it's like, how could you not have a Dolly Parton station or a Celine Dion station or all of these women? Taylor Swift station. So like
Madonna.
A Madonna station, right? So there's all these subtle ways in which sexism occurs. But it was so fascinating this year to watch the Barbie movie become the most successful Warner Brothers movie of all time. And
written and directed by a woman.
Right. Yeah. And about female empowerment, or at least Barbie, whatever Barbie means to you. And how shocked everybody was but how hungry so many people were for a feminist take.
The same thing happened when Crazy Rich Asians came out. It was this astonishment that it did so well, and it's just like, well, when you deprive something like 7 to 10% of Americans of a particular voice and face, and we're not even talking about specific Japanese American. We're just talking about just any old Asian. You know, I don't think there was a single Japanese character in that movie. It was all, I think it was, what did it take place in Singapore, I believe. Anyway, point is that great, but if it's anything like Crazy Rich Asians, it'll be another 10 years before another movie like this comes out.
Yeah. So the other thing that feminism has done that women might not know is that if you are an American woman with a credit card that your daddy or your husband didn't need to sign for, that comes out of the feminist movement. Before the mid-70s, women could not buy a house or get a credit card or maybe even a checking account without permission from their husbands or dads.
Yeah, you and I were old enough to remember how weird things were. My mom regularly referred to herself and was referred to as Mrs. Allen Honda. Mm-hmm. She didn't even have a first name. Mm-hmm. She was just... Which I'm guessing to young people today, that sounds utterly bizarre. Mm-hmm. It sounds like something out of some weird culture from another land and another time, that my mom would receive letters or be designated on a roster or refer to herself as Mrs. Allen. I'm just imagining myself walking around the world calling myself Mr. Stacy Honda. Well, I guess it would be her maiden name that we... Can I just have at least a first name?
Right.
You know, is that okay with you? It's bizarre. And that legacy is still with us. It's just not as overt, right?
Right.
Feminism also gives us the research that looks into all sorts of phenomena, including meetings at work, where when men talk, everyone listens. And when women talk, everyone, including women, by the way, have been shown to... They can't wait for that woman to shut up, or if that woman is asserting herself in the exact same way as a man, then she's seen as bitchy or bossy or something. And any old man, and they've done research where it could be a man who is lowest in the org chart, and because he's talking, even the president, who might be a woman, is just like galvanized by what he's saying, because we've been socialized to believe that men are... good leaders just by default and women are not.
Well, and that they know.
Right.
Right. Like, no matter how much I know, I'm rarely seen as an expert. Even though I have 25 years in the mental health field. It's like, how, you know, what do I need to do to be of equal standing to someone else?
As evidenced by the mansplaining.
Yes.
Like, there's these classic examples of women who are auto shop owners, for example.
I have a good story.
They will have some sort of event with a car or some moment where the subject of cars and engines and auto stuff comes up, and some random guy who doesn't know shit about shit just starts mansplaining to her about engines and stuff, and she's just giggling on the inside, just like, my God.
This actually happened in downtown Seattle. Somehow, both of the bolts, this is when we had a... VW Bug, somehow both of the bolts of the door sheared off. And so the door was like literally disconnected from the car. And it was fascinating, the men that came up and were like, oh, little lady, let me help you put that back on. And I'd be like, sir, I would like to show you that the bolts are literally sheared off. Like, it's not like I don't know how to close the door to the car. But, you know, you're not allowed to... I clearly couldn't be an expert on my own disaster, but I also, you know, I can't be an expert on my own body. And I was recently looking on YouTube, and two men came up. I didn't even watch it, but it was these two men discussing hormone replacement for therapy for women. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to watch that. Like, I can't even imagine what that...
Wait, what? What was it?
It was... I don't even know why the algorithm would have sent me this, but it was two men discussing hormone replacement.
Like physicians or...
I don't even know, but I was like, I don't even want to listen because...
Well, why wouldn't you want to listen? If it's two experts, they would know things.
It didn't express in the ad that they were experts, but the idea would be very low that they would know more than...
Well, not more, but they might know things, you know, it's two men... You know, experts on hormone replacement for women could know things. Or
I'll check it out. And
no, don't
back.
Watch it. I'm just saying, like, to just discount it, I think actually part of the problem, because this notion of just like, well, therefore all men are idiots. And then and that attitude will cause a lot of people, including women, to say like, well, if that's what feminism is, then that's wrong. Mm-hmm. You're prejudging.
So the other thing would be just go to a magazine rack. No one buys magazines anymore, but look at how many magazines, just pick up like a Vogue magazine and see how much of it is about makeup and clothes for women.
And losing weight.
And losing weight. And just being imagined. I mean, even I don't really even care about makeup and I buy a ton of it. Just because I've been socialized that like this will make my life better. Kirk, how much money do you spend on makeup a year?
Zero.
Do you believe that buying any makeup product will make your life better?
No.
And so even though I am like a dyed-in-the-wool feminist, I still, you know, am looking for the perfect product to make my skin flawless. Right. When it's like, I know in my heart that this isn't true.
Is that from childhood or,
oh, yeah,
or from adulthood or both? Or,
and probably how much unconscious, you know, it's just marketed at me constantly.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be fascinating for us to compare our Instagram feeds and how much my Instagram feeds are about push-up bras and cover up and makeup that will cover up all my flaws.
Wow.
Like probably 90% of the ads that are sent to me are those two things.
What, push-up bras?
Many ads for push-up bras.
For what purpose?
To make my boobs look bigger, to make me look more attractive to men.
Oh, push-up bras. Yeah, right. And the privilege that I have as a man to
never think about push-up bras.
Well, more generally, I can wake up in the morning and I could literally not even shower or wash my hair or comb my hair. And no one would think I was wrong for going to work looking like that or going to a nice dinner looking like that. Like, I don't have to do anything to impress anybody. And I can have flaws all over the place. You know, I could have weird things going on. And it's like, well, you know, that's what men are like. And that's okay. But a woman does that and she's lazy and disgusting or not doing her womanly duties. And research shows that people don't listen to people who don't present, women who don't present in a certain feminine manner that's supposed to be mainstream, right? With makeup and dresses and high heels and all the things, you know.
And I can't tell you how many older female clients I've had who said, wow, when I presented this same issue that I'm talking to you about now in the 70s or 80s to a male therapist, they literally told me, why don't you just put some lipstick on and feel better?
Wait, what? Yes. What did you start? What was the prompt for that?
Depression, anxiety, addressing abuse.
You're talking about those things?
Yeah.
And the therapist said, what?
Why don't you just put some red lipstick on, honey, and you'll feel better and basically shut up.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right. And it's bizarre to think that a therapist would think, well, would have the foundational assumption that women, if they just change their attitude and make themselves more presentable to men, then everything will be fine because I will be fine with that. Because
they'll look better to me.
Because women don't matter. They're basically just either automatons or animals or simple or something. And if you just have to, they're not complicated, right?
Right. So just look prettier, honey. And
that'll make me feel better.
Right. Yeah.
So therefore the world is better.
Yeah.
And you don't matter. Yeah. Right. So the next question from Leslie is, what do you think about woke feminism? Do you know what woke feminism?
Can you describe woke feminism?
Well, so do you remember when woke became a popular word like 10 years ago? What did it mean to you?
I mean, at the time it meant addressing diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Right. It meant being aware. You're awake.
Yes.
As opposed to being asleep to the realities of society and oppression. You have been awakened or awakened. Which is it? Awakened?
Awakened.
And
I awoke you.
And I remember thinking of woke as a positive word, not as a word to attack anybody, but as a word to indicate that even for people of color like myself, there is an awakening process that I went through. I went through it in my 20s when I was becoming a part of society and a therapist. I took a lot of classes and thought a lot about a thing, you know, read a lot of stuff and furthered my understanding of my own experience with oppression. And I would say that at that time, I was awakened. That's my definition of woke. But pretty quickly, people that are not friendly to ideas of feminism and racism, I suppose, to our contemporary ideas, they took the word woke and used it as an insult. They would they would say, oh, look at that woke person. So very quickly, and I remember I had some friends from Arizona who came up to visit. This would have been 2016, 2017, and we were talking about politics, and I said something like, well, you know, yeah, they're woke, or I said something woke as a positive thing. Mm-hmm. And they laughed at me because they thought I was making a joke. Mm. So in Arizona, the word had become a bad word, something to make fun of someone. But in my world, woke still meant something good. Mm-hmm. And I remember being confused by that. And they were pushing back on the ideas that I was saying. I'm like, oh, like, anyway. So now the word woke, though, has been very much, at least online, has been completely changed to be an insult. So if even among liberals, if they call someone online woke, what they're often referring to is someone who takes things way too far.
Mm-hmm.
And someone who almost does a 360 and comes back around and is now oppressing other people.
There are people who really ask other people to think and consider and look at dynamics of oppression, and it is overwhelming to other people.
Yeah.
And therefore they make fun of it because they don't want to do that level of analysis or questioning or wondering about why things are the way they are.
And well,
they don't want to look at their privileges.
Yeah. And that's a huge barrier, right? It's hard. It's hard to accept, you know, it's doesn't feel good. And also when you've been indoctrinated into an ideology of dehumanizing and demeaning of the oppressed groups, when the oppressed groups start talking about things, then you just slot your all that into the dehumanization and disregarding. It's like, well, I've been trained that you're an idiot and you don't know what you're talking about. So you're telling me that I'm the idiot and I don't know what I'm talking about? No, you're the idiot. So I'm just going to stay in that zone. And I benefit because as a person of privilege, then I get the power that I can retain. Anyway, so the next question that Leslie asks is, what do you think about the live-action Disney woke feminism? Do you know about this?
No. It's hard to keep up.
The actress Rachel Zegler or Ziegler. I don't know. So she's an actress. She was in, the only thing I've seen her in, I believe, is West Side Story, the remake.
Yes.
She was the lead. And I believe that she is part Colombian American, part European American. And as my friend Umberto found out with his DNA, is that a lot of Colombians, particularly light-skinned Colombians, are Spanish or of origin because, of course, of the colonialization, the conquistadors. And so what do we call them racially, right? That they'll call them, you know, that's why on some forms it'll say non-Hispanic white, right? Because it's saying Hispanic people, a lot of them are white. Now, there's a lot of people in Colombia who are black, who are native Colombian. Anyway, point is that there's that scenario where you have an actress, and the next movie that is being made in the live action Disney movies is Snow White. Did you know about this?
Yes. And she is, who is playing Snow White?
Her.
Right. Yeah.
And so the immediate backlash is, but, well, what do you think the immediate backlash is?
Right, Snow White is white.
Right.
And I just want to say I watched the live-action Little Mermaid, and they try and do a lot of racial diversity, but it was a scandal that the lead was black for that one.
Right. Yeah. What do you think about that?
That's kind of outrageous. And what's interesting is her dad is Hispanic in the casting of that movie.
Yeah.
I mean, the world is diverse, and it's going to be hard to watch white people.
And we're talking about mermaids, so there's no tradition around skin color with mermaids. These are magical creatures, so let it go, people.
And that role is based for someone that has a great voice, and that woman had a great voice, and it's very sweet. So I'm imagining that as TV and movies begin to represent more what's actually true of the racial representation or the racial makeup of our world, as our media begins to reflect that, I imagine if you only want to see white protagonists, it's going to be very, very hard.
And why would you? I mean, as an Asian American myself, I've been idolizing all sorts of white characters, Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, Princess Leia, and I was okay with that. So now it's your time, white people. You can be okay with worshiping characters that don't exactly look like you. Is that okay with you?
So did you watch Ahsoka?
I did and did not like it.
Mm.
But, you know, each to their own.
Me to watch two women sword fight was so exciting to have so many of the characters be female. Shout out to Issa Davis, my friend from seventh grade, who has a cameo.
Oh, really?
Yes. I screamed. So it was very... I found the sword fighting incredibly exciting, especially because I can't remember the last time I saw two women really fight like that.
So you bring up the Little Mermaid.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the amount of hatred and grasping of pearls that you would have a black character play the lead in Little Mermaid, she was being attacked and everyone was freaking out. And, you know, if you look at any movie that's being remade, there's always going to be some worry and some skepticism. You know, when I see a remake of a movie that I loved, I'm always like, I hope they don't screw it up. But if they do, then whatever, it's not the end of the world. But when they change it in ways regarding women playing traditionally male characters or people of color playing traditional white characters, then we see people really freaking out. What it looks like to me with the reaction is that, okay, you know, it's fine to say, Little Mermaid is very dear to me. I hope they don't screw it up. Fine. And it's also completely fine to say, yeah, Little Mermaid, not for me. But to be fueled by racism and to go after the movie extra hard because you've been indoctrinated into this notion that black people need to just go away, or that I don't want to look at black people.
No character you love would be played by a black person.
Right, right.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, that's a better point. So with that is obvious to me anyway in terms of the public discourse. Having said all that, with Little Mermaid, so the YouTube listeners asked me to watch the original and react to it, and I did, and so I posted that for the YouTube members.
And may I say, for women of that generation who watch that movie over and over and over again, it is the most archetypal character that comes up in art therapy. There's so much talk about Ariel's hair. I've made Ariel dolls with people. I've processed Ariel so much. So, you know, thinking about what role models girls are given about relationships, Ariel is a horrible role model.
Yeah. Well, my very quick synopsis of my reaction was that the beginning of the movie, there are some feminist ideas that she doesn't have to follow in the traditional way. She is an adventurer. She isn't this helpless little creature. You know, she has power. She knows things. So in the beginning, there's this, I would say if a little girl were watching this, I would be like, yeah, it's not a bad role model. Although you could, anyway. But then the second half, when she loses her voice, then everything returns to Disneyville. And
right.
She, I get that that's the original story or something, like it's from some
Hans
old
Christian Andersen, yeah.
But she can't communicate at all except to look pretty and to look like a princess.
And talk about trauma options. She's fawning all over the place, right? Her only option is to blink her eyes and try and get someone's attention.
And he falls in love with her. Now, he desperately wants to hear her voice, but it's her singing voice, not necessarily for her to talk, right? And he does fall in love with her. If left to his own devices, he would have married her, but then, you know, the witch cast a spell.
And Ursula is a huge feminist icon.
Okay.
And gay icon.
Okay. I heard that. So the movie, I thought, played both of those messages. The other thing I'll say about the remake was that I didn't watch the remake, but I did watch the ending because I was curious as to how they were going to... Because one of the things that's happening that the opponents of this movement, our movement, if you will, inclusion movement, the opponents will say that we are the makers of these movies, they will include what they call the Mary Sue. Have you heard of this idea? So it's a... I don't know the history of it, but I hear it a lot from critics. And the idea is that writers, as a way to try to fast track feminism into the script, they will create a female character that has no flaws and can do everything well.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not good storytelling, because like with any good character, they have to have some kind of flaw. They have to have some struggle. They eventually prevail. Luke Skywalker eventually blows up the Death Star, but there's a journey along the way. There's a learning, there's a transformation process. You can't just have a character start as a god and never do anything wrong and kick ass. I mean, to me, that's a Happy Days episode. That's Fonzie. You know, that I remember when I was like 10 or 7, I loved Fonzie because he could do no wrong. But when I was 20 and watching Happy Days, I was like, this character is an idiot. You know, it's just like he just kicks ass, you know, or Arnold Schwarzenegger kind of characters. You know, that's a simplistic way of looking at things. And so what a lot of people like House of the Dragon, you watch House of the Dragon, right?
I talk about a show I couldn't make it through. I couldn't make it through.
Okay. Well, you could argue that Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon is mostly about women, strong women characters. Mm-hmm. You have Sansa, you have Arya, you have Cersei, you have Brienne, you have the Khaleesi. I can't remember. It's been a while. And in House of Dragon, it's a similar thing. But there's a character arc for each of these characters. They're not just...
Many arcs, ups and downs.
Yeah, they're not just automatically awesome at everything. Mm-hmm. That's not good story. It's not interesting, right? Regardless of gender, we want to watch stories that are compelling. We don't want to see something shoehorned in, you know what I mean? So with The Little Mermaid, I was wondering, because at the end of the cartoon, he climbs on the boat and rams it into Ursula, right? Mm-hmm. The point is that the man saves the day, and The Little Mermaid, the woman, is this hapless creature. And so I thought, well, they have to update that, because there's no way that they're going to keep that in the script. And they shouldn't, because it's supposed to be a story about the Little Mermaid. The Little Mermaid should defeat Ursula, right? And so I thought, well, how are they going to do that? Because the way that the story is that he takes the boat and rams it into her. But I thought, you can't do that. You can't have her ram the boat into Ursula, because she's not a sailor. She doesn't know anything about boats. She's an underwater creature. So I was like, well, what does she know? Well, she does know about underwater shit. So she should... they should set up something that she knows about, and then pays off later, where she maybe gets a bunch of those dolphins that have those horns. What do they call those?
Narwhals.
Narwhals. Or she has some knowledge of the waves or something.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And then I saw the ending, and they just had her on the boat ramming it in. And I thought, well, that is a legit criticism, you know? Like, yeah, make her win.
Yeah.
But make her win in a story that makes sense. Don't just recreate the same story beat, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, there's very little character development for women in movies.
Right. So it could be argued that this is just another version of oppression on women, that you would create characters that don't, you shoehorn them in.
Right.
But you don't give them a story. You don't give them complexity.
Yeah. Well, and... You know, are the princesses... I mean, there's a reason that Ursula is a gay icon and a feminist icon, because she's a far more interesting character, far more complex than The Little Mermaid.
Right.
It's interesting. All of the references we have come up with today are all under the Disney handle. So it has this huge influence on our culture. It's trying the very best that it can to do racial diversity. But here we are telling the same stories over and over and over again. I don't have any big thoughts about it.
No. I have a lot of thought on that, but I won't bore you with it. But that's my thought, is create new stories for people of color. Create new stories for women.
Right. Which don't is just... why the Barbie movie was so...
Right.
And that was a theater of the absurd movie. I mean, what was the plot there?
Yeah. And there was no IP, meaning it's not a Star Wars remake or a...
Right.
Or a Ghostbusters remake. It was this brand new idea about Barbie. I mean, of Barbie as an IP, but as a movie character, I don't think we've ever seen that before. I'm guessing there's been like movies for kids or something, but not like a blockbuster movie. And you can do that. You could create a whole new universe for superheroes that's not Marvel or DC, and have more diversity in it. You know?
So my current feminist storytelling person that I go to who can do no wrong in my eyes is Natasha Lyonne. Did you watch Poker Face? Is that what it's called?
No, but I watched that other show and we talked about it on the podcast.
Russian Doll.
Right.
So her storytelling is female driven.
Yeah.
Poker Face is often much older character driven. You don't see that all the time. And it is a female anti-hero hero who is getting herself in all kinds of trouble and doesn't get along with her family and is on the run from the mob, and all of these things are happening, and it's so funny and interesting and unpredictable. And I just think it's really interesting storytelling, and it's really influenced how I teach my workshops. Because it's really blown the lid off of the construct to me of what is, because leading, so I lead these all day 6-hour workshops, and my joke has always been that they're 6-hour performance pieces. But it's really blown the lid off of things I want to talk about, and how much more music I want to do, and how much more art-based I want to do, and how much more I want to take people on a journey, because I've seen Natasha Lyonne do it. Yeah. She really takes you on a journey, and you don't know where you are halfway in, and you don't really care because you're incredibly entertained. Mm-hmm. And that is, to me, super powerful. For her, in particular, Jewish feminist storytelling.
Russian Doll was... again, a brand new idea. It's not like a remake of Batman or something. Mm-hmm. And very interesting character, very interesting story, very compelling. Her acting, the choices, her friends that she had. There was a lot of diversity in the friends, both in terms of gender and race and sexuality, right? In terms of like polyamory seemingly was being presented. And it was an amazing story and interesting and modern and all that stuff, you know, and that sort of storytelling and that sort of depiction is great to see, not only because it's a great story, but it's also like, okay, thank you. It'd be nice to have more women represented, but to just take these old stories and just slap whatever you need to shoehorn in to satisfy what they think to be satisfying us, mm-hmm. you know, like if Disney, instead of making a live remake of Snow White, just create, like, I watched Coco the other night for the 10th time and just cried the entire time. Coco, as far as I know anyway, that storyline is not some story that is being retold. Mm-hmm. I think, I could be wrong, it's a completely reinvented story that involves Mexicans. So it's this brand new story. So if you want to, and I applaud Disney if they want to create more diversity, then stop remaking old white stories. You know what I mean?
Well, and Encanto is another example. Talk about Encanto while I bring up the cast.
Encanto is great also, Colombian. And Turning Red, which is about Asian Canadians, I believe. Just amazing stories with very large amounts of money that they're making. And so just stop with the shoehorning in.
So what's really interesting about Encanto is the very strong sister, Luisa. Disney was not prepared at all that she would become the most popular character from that movie. Mm. And so there was no Luisa dolls. There was no Luisa costumes. Very interesting that when the movie came out, that's who all the little girls wanted to be.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Because she's strong.
Because she's strong. Yeah. And she's vulnerable.
And who doesn't want to be strong?
Yeah.
But Rebecca, girls don't want to be strong. Boys want to be strong.
I know.
Girls want to be dainty and pretty like the other sister.
Right.
Yeah.
The other sister, is that Maribel?
No, it's the.
It's Isabel.
Yeah.
It's very interesting when you give people a wide variety of things to be what people actually... And actually, the reason Dory... we're going on a different Disney movie.
Finding Dory.
Yeah. The reason that Dory got her own movie was that Disney did a survey of, like, who's the most popular Disney character of all time? And they thought it was going to be Mickey Mouse, and it was Dory. And so, you know, there's a character who's lost and befuddled and lovable. And isn't that interesting?
That's a good movie, too. I rewatched that recently. So very briefly, before moving on to the last question, because you got to get out of here, about the live action Disney remake of Snow White. I actually had to look up on
who's gonna be
on Reddit as to... There's a subreddit called Out of the Loop that I pay attention to a lot. A month ago, someone asked the question, what's up with all the hate and negativity towards Rachel Zegler? And so someone says here, she was cast as Snow White in the live action remake from Disney. There have been clips taken from a few interviews about the role where she has had some very questionable responses. She talks negatively about some of the themes in the movie. So I thought we would actually listen to those clips right now.
I'm looking at her now.
So let's listen to this clip.
You said you were bringing a modern edge to it on stage. What do you mean by that?
I just mean that it's no longer 1937, and we absolutely wrote a Snow White that
is not going to be saved by the prince.
She's not going to be saved by the prince, and she's not going to be dreaming about true love. She's dreaming about becoming the leader she knows she can be, and the leader that her late father told her that she could be if she was fearless, fair, brave, and true. And so it's just a really incredible story for, I think, young people everywhere to see themselves in.
So thoughts on that, Rebecca?
That's not negative to me.
No.
To say that maybe since 1934, a depiction of a young woman would be updated.
Yeah.
Because in that movie, she truly is asleep until her prince shows up.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I mean, I could never even think of Snow White as a leader like that. It would never even cross my mind if I think about the original liturgy that I know growing up with.
Right. So when I was clicking on these earlier, I thought I was going to see clips of, because I had heard about these rumblings, and I thought that she had somehow maybe gone too far, or she made a mistake, and there were other clips too, but they're all kind of in that zone. And it just, again, shows how sexist we are in our society that a woman would say this sort of thing and would create, you know, it's one thing for someone to be like, I don't really like that take. It's another thing to, as an aggregate of how society acts, that you would have that much negative attention on her because of what she's saying. And the other thing is to attack her. She, you know, I hope people understand that actors don't write and direct and film and edit. Actors are a piece of a very large puzzle, and not a huge piece of that puzzle. The producers, the writers, the directors, everyone.
Casting agents.
Yeah, the makeup people, the special effects people. These people are just as important, if not more important. So to attack an actress for what a movie is going to be is just one of the dumbest things. Like, if you want to attack someone, you know, that's why with Ahsoka, I don't fault any of the actors. They're great. I mean, some of those actors I love. Rosario Dawson, the woman who plays the green lady. I can't remember her name. She's a great actress. And it was good to see, I believe, a half Asian in the character of, what's her name? Well, that's the whole thing. It's like, I watched Rebels and I watched Ahsoka, and I can't. Do you remember her name?
No.
Right. Do you remember any of their names?
No.
Aside from Ahsoka.
But I love the space whale. I'd like to be. Maybe that's what I'll be for Halloween next year, is a gigantic space whale.
I'd love to see that. So another. Then reading on, what they will say is that the original story is a German folktale, Snow White. The original story of Snow White is a traditional German folktale, and it includes a line saying that Snow White is said to have skin as white as snow, and people have questioned why a Hispanic woman would be cast to portray her.
She's really light-skinned.
Yeah, that. And, okay, I guess if a German person were to feel slighted somehow by someone from mostly Europe, by the way, you know, her
and
ancestry.
No German actual person is that. I mean, this is a talk about racism, like this idea that there is some German person out there whose skin is literally white as snow. You know, that is a myth in itself. I mean, right, that is a ideal of colonialism, that there is this magical white woman out there who is completely pure.
Right.
And it's okay that we can challenge that a little bit.
Right. Yeah.
And that's why I buy all that makeup, right? Because I'm trying to have that flawless skin. And I'm super light-skinned, and like, you know,
Wait, you wear makeup to make your skin whiter?
No, I just try and even it out.
Oh.
Now I'm going to look up the original Snow White.
Last
I just... She wasn't so white!
So I just want to do one more before you
okay.
go. Okay.
Now, so I just want to say the original Snow White was not as white as you imagined her to be.
Yeah.
Go and look at her now.
Anonymous middle tier patron, she says, I was watching one of your videos on Mildred from Ultimatum. Remember that? Remember Mildred?
How could I ever forget?
I have someone in my life similar to her. For those who didn't watch the reality show Ultimatum, Mildred is allegedly someone who is or had been abusive to her partner. And some of that was depicted on the show and some of that was described by an alleged victim in a later interview. So anonymous military patron says, I have someone in my life similar to Mildred. She can get to the place of actually feeling her emotions, but she can't admit her part in the situation and will begin to talk about suicide, possibly to get the person back. As a friend, I don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. I think there's a blind preventing her from seeing that it keeps happening over and over again. It sucks because she keeps unknowingly pushing people away. Mm-hmm. When I recommend she goes to therapy, it's an automatic no. I'm not sure how to confront her when at times she initiated and escalated a situation. She admitted once and she felt guilty for her behavior and felt like she couldn't tell if she was at fault. So it sounds like anonymous military patron has a friend who is confiding in her, and patron is saying, I think you're partially to blame there, and you're shooting yourself in the foot, and maybe you should go to therapy, and she's always saying no. So what should anonymous military patron do?
I mean, you're allowed to set limits if somebody's behavior is really making you uncomfortable. It's, you know, not everybody can... So this is all making me think about dialectical behavioral therapy, which this person doesn't want to go to. But it really is a feminist and Buddhist paradigm of how to reconstruct and relook at your behaviors, how to slow down your anger outbursts, how to find ways to stay present even when your emotions feel untenable, how to really... So there's this whole kind of both and wise mind aspect where you're really trained how to look at yourself again and look at situations. And yeah, if somebody's not willing to learn new skills, it can be really hard to watch somebody self-destruct like that and push everyone. It sounds like she's pushing people away.
Yeah. 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 I've had people in my personal life like this as well. And I am in a good position to go on a campaign to convince them to go to therapy or even maybe suggest compassionate from me. I could give them compassion and help them maybe to see that we all have our issues, and I might even self-disclose or lead the way by, well, I've been in that situation and I'm convinced that I'm not to blame. But then later I think, well, maybe I'm at least 10% to blame, which can, you know, I can do all those things and yet fail. Because the person just, you can lead a horse to water, as they say.
Right. I mean, a person has to be ready to change.
Yeah.
And that's the hardest thing. You can suggest all kinds of things or wish things for people, but until it really makes a difference to that person to see that their behavior is not leading to the life that they want, folks aren't going to change.
Yeah. The times where I say it did work was I would try to level with them in a way that was not coming down on them. I was trying to level with them, like to say, look, I don't know, and I'm your friend and I love you, but I've just been having these thoughts and I don't know, you know, I'm not your therapist. I'm not, but I just had these thoughts. I'm just going to throw it out there and I could be wrong. And I try to say enough to get the point across, but not too much because I don't want to overwhelm them. And I might see a slight, you know, they'll probably reject it, but maybe there's a little bit of a seed that gets planted, you know? And then 6 months later, there's another opportunity, you know? But, you know, if I want to be in a relationship with this person, then I don't want to burn the bridge, you know? So I have to accept that I don't know, you know? I'm not their therapist. What the fuck do I know? So I'm just throwing shit out there.
Well, and also, even if someone is in therapy and this is their issue, this is long-term behavior change. This isn't going to change overnight. And I mean, the interesting part about watching Mildred is to watch her do the same behaviors over and over and over again. And you can even see, like, she kind of wants, for me in the reunion episode, it felt like she just couldn't stop herself. Once she got rolling, she just was on that tape.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, it's it's really hard to do something different, especially if you feel flooded or under attack. Or and often folks that have Mildred's presentation feel under attack all the time.
Right. Yeah. And the relational traumas that Mildred went through, and I'm guessing your friend, patron, are so significant. It's hard. It's really, really hard. So, yeah. All right. Well, that was a weird episode, Rebecca.
We went all over the map.
And tune in next time with the next Rebecca Sode. And please take care of yourself, because
we're heading into the holidays. And just be nice to yourself. Yeah. Just make it through the holidays. If you can.